The city held its breath in the soft dark before dawn. Row houses slept behind narrow yards. A single car idled on a side street, exhaust lifting into the streetlight like a low fog. At 4:13 a.m., January 22, 2023, a burst of gunfire cracked the quiet. Windows blinked awake. A dog barked twice and went silent. The idling engine died. He lay half in the gutter, one arm across his chest, phone beside his shoe. Streetlight pooled on the screen. Missed calls. A text half written. Tires hissed past at a distance, then did not return. Somewhere down the block, a baby cried. Sirens were still minutes away. By the time first responders reached him, the air carried the thin bite of winter and the hot metal smell from casings on the asphalt. A number was assigned. A scene was taped. A case file began. In the quiet that followed, the question formed and would not leave. Who pulled the trigger and why? Chapter 1. The call on a sleeping block. The dispatcher marked it as shots fired with a possible victim down. The first unit rolled in from three blocks out, moving slow with lights off to avoid spooking anyone still in the area. The time in the log read 4:19 a.m. The officers parked wide of the address, stepped out, and listened. The block was still. The cold made every sound sharp. A furnace clicked on in a basement. Somewhere a late bus sighed. They saw the dark shape by the curb and moved in. One officer tracked the sidewalk. The other cut a line in the street, scanning stoops and windows. They reached him together. He was young. 20s. A jacket too light for the hour. Knees bent like he had tried to sit. No wallet in hand. No visible weapon. The phone lay screen up, a blue glow on wet asphalt. The officers called out for medics. They cleared the immediate area for hazards and cars. They checked for movement in the houses facing the scene and got faces in glass and blinds that closed again. The medic unit arrived at 4:23 a.m. A second patrol car sealed the far end of the street. Tape went up across the crown of the block. Yellow line to the north. Yellow line to the south. The streetlights threw the tape's shadow like another set of bars. The medics worked fast. One officer kept a simple running timeline into body-worn audio. Time of contact. Initial assessment. Items seen near the victim. Positions of shell casings, as marked by a boot tip and memory for later. The smell of hot metal stayed close to the ground. The air was too cold to carry anything else for long. At 4:31 a.m., the medics called it. The officers slowed their voices. They had done this before. They would do it again. They moved with care that showed on their faces only when no one else watched. One officer pulled a paper evidence bag and lifted the phone with a gloved hand. The lock screen showed a face in a tiny circle and the ghost of a message in the preview bar. The officer dimmed the display and sealed the bag. Detectives from the homicide unit were notified at 4:36 a.m. The on-call pair turned through dark streets that still held leftover ice along the gutters. Traffic signals blinked red on empty corners. They had triage to do before they stepped out. Where else had shots been fired tonight? What other scenes were still hot? Which call had the better chance of catching heat if they moved fast? They pressed the question down and pointed the car to this block. A body in the street shifted the scale. Crime scene arrived behind them. The van's back doors opened to lights and kits. The lead detective, a calm presence in a dark knit hat, took the first slow walk. Shoes on the dry lane. Eyes low, then high, then low again. A shell casing by the storm drain had settled into a tiny crescent of road grit. Another glinted near the front tire of a sedan with frost on the hood. The detective counted them in a quiet voice. Each number would become a marker, then a photograph, then a line in a report. Neighbors gathered at the tape in heavy coats and house shoes. Questions carried across the cold. Who is it? Is he from here? Did anyone see the car? Officers answered with short words that gave nothing away. Please step back. We will let you know when we can. If you saw anything, please wait by the cruiser. People nodded. A few did not. The detective reached the victim and paused. The face held the soft slackness of sleep that came after the medics. He had an earring in the left ear, a thin chain at the collar, hands with short nails, and a scar over the knuckle of the right index finger. The kind of detail a family would recognize. The kind of detail that would matter when they needed to say the words no one wants to hear. At 5:02 a.m., a lieutenant made the first brief call to the watch commander. One fatality. Male. Approximate age late 20s. Multiple shell casings recovered. No obvious cameras with line of sight. Units canvassing. Notification to the office of the chief medical examiner pending. The lieutenant kept his voice even. They always kept their voices even at this hour. The canvas began in a slow grid. North side first. Then south. Porches with wooden steps. Porches with concrete. Doorbells that did not work. Dogs that barked until their owners said names in low voices. One woman had recorded audio without knowing it. Her security camera did not catch the street, but caught sound. Three sharp cracks. A pause. Two more. A car engine racing, a quick turn, and tires on grit. The time stamp read 4:13 a.m. It matched the first 911 call within a minute. Another neighbor had a camera pointed at a yard light. The lens flared whenever anything passed. At 4:12 a.m., the flare shaped into two silhouettes and fell away. At 4:13 a.m., the flare again. A vehicle's high beams swept the porches and clipped the frame. Details were thin. The pattern mattered anyway. The team logged the files and asked permission for copies. The neighbors gave it. People always gave it on the first morning. By afternoon, the world would harden back up. At sunrise, the tape held a small crowd. The detectives looked up and down the block and saw the shift happen. Light helped. It also made the scene ordinary again. A mail carrier paused. A man with a briefcase turned toward a side street and kept walking. The city opened. The investigators had hours to lock the fragile things in place before noise swallowed them. The phone went to digital forensics after quick photographs in a portable light tent by the van. The case agent signed it out. The screen was still locked. The hope was in the metadata. Last calls. Last messages. Last tower handoff. Maybe a thread with a name and a plan to meet. Maybe nothing. The agent did not say hope out loud. The job ran better without that word. By mid-morning, a family member called the district station to ask about a cousin who had not come home. The desk sergeant spoke gently and asked for a description. He asked for identifying marks and clothes last seen. He took a number. He said someone would call back soon. He wrote the details on a pad already half full with other details from other nights. He knew how the day would go. He did not let it touch his voice. Detectives drove to the address on the intake card. A row house with a narrow porch and a wind chime made of shells that clicked in the winter air. A woman opened the door and pulled a sweater closed at the neck. She looked at their faces and knew. The lead detective asked for a seat inside. He asked for a name to confirm. He asked if there was someone the woman would like to call to be with her. He said the words in a low, steady tone. The room took the hit. The woman did not fall. She held the back of a chair and stared past the detective at a family photo on the wall. They asked what he had planned the night before. Work schedule. Friends he met. Places he liked to park. Any trouble. Any arguments. The woman answered each question with the same even stare and then a breath that shook. He had talked about a job interview. He had done a late drop for a delivery app. He had said he would be home by 2. He was careful. He did not run with people who did dirt. He kept his head down. He had a small tattoo on his chest that only family knew. A cousin arrived and sat on the arm of the chair without asking. She scrolled through her phone and found messages from the night before. A contact saved under a first name and a flower icon. Plans to meet. A location 2 blocks from the scene. The last message sent at 4:07 a.m. said he was there. Said, "Where are you?" No reply. The cousin handed the phone to the detective without a word. Back on the block, crime scene marked the last casing and lifted it with a delicate pinch. Photography worked in a ring from the outside in. Wide to tight. North to south. Each frame would later become a map in the mind. The team looked for shoe patterns in salt dust. They found a partial heel that cut across the gutter line and disappeared in a scuff. They marked it and cast it. They knew 100 heels would match if they had to search 1,000 closets. Still, they cast it. The work was in the habit. At noon, the detective stood at the trunk of the car and built a board from a fresh pad and tape. Victim name, age, education, work, family, last known movements, physical items recovered, digital items pending, leads to a sign. The board calmed the room even when the room was a street and the heater in the cruiser rattled the paper. The board did not care about luck. It only asked for the next step. They split the work. One detective took the flower icon contact. One took the delivery app. One took nearby cameras with better angles. One called the medical examiner to confirm chain of custody and set a time to attend. The case agent filed the first press line with the Public Information Office. Male, late 20s. Fatal shooting in the early morning hours. Detectives seeking information. Tip line provided. No name released pending next of kin notification. The family had been told. The city had not. In the afternoon, the apartment of the victim gave up small signs. A pantry with grocery staples. A stack of application printouts on the table. A shoebox with pay stubs. A clipped bus pass taped to the inside of a cabinet for quick grab on early mornings. On the nightstand, a photo of a boy at a park in a blue shirt, hand up to block the sun. A folded paper behind the frame with a list of goals. Save for a car. Get a certificate. Help mom with bills. The detective read it and put it back with care. By early evening, the day's light had failed. The block had returned to the people who lived there. Children raced scooters along the sidewalk until parents called them in. A man with a rake made a tidy pile of damp leaves and paused to look at the corner where the tape had been. The tape was gone. The question stayed. The detectives met again in a small room at the bureau with a map pinned to the wall. They set up 3-time cards across the table. For AM, he leaves his last delivery 2 neighborhoods away. For 07 AM, he texts the contact with the flower icon that he is at the meet. For 13 AM gunfire on the block. The line between cards was 6 minutes. In 6 minutes, 100 tiny things could go right or wrong. They looked for the one that mattered. A technician from Digital Forensics entered with first pass data. The phone had been locked, but notifications left residue. The last number to call him had hung up at 4:06 AM. The device had handed off between 2 towers at 4:11 AM, placing it inside a small wedge that covered the block. A rideshare app had been opened at 3:58 a.m. and then closed again. No driver accepted. The messaging app for the contact with the flower icon used an end-to-end platform. Some data still lived on the device. Some did not. The technician laid a photo on the table. It was the lock screen image taken by the scene unit before bagging. The blue glow had hinted at a draft. In the deep data, a few characters of that draft remained. The letters spelled a name fragment and a question. It was not much, but it was something a human had tried to say seconds before the sound that ended the night. The lead detective stood and looked at the map. He traced the path from the last delivery to the block. He traced the likely path of the car that left the scene on the audio. He traced a loop that returned 2 streets over where cameras might be better. He asked for a team to run that loop in the morning. He asked for canvas again, this time with day shift faces that might get different answers. People remembered new things when they made eggs and coffee. People told the second team what they could not tell the first. At 9:12 p.m., the detectives drove back to the block one more time. They sat in the dark and watched. A man in a deep hood walked past the spot where the tape had been. He did not look down. He did not look up. He moved with a practiced pace. The detectives filed the image to memory and let the man go. They were not there to make a stop on a feeling. They were there to listen to a street that had not yet decided to talk. Night settled again. The temperature dropped. Porch lights clicked off in ones and twos. The city held its breath a second time. The case had begun in a rush and now entered the slow. Paper would be written. Calls would be logged. A lab would lift prints from a casing and likely find none that told a story. Weeks would pass in lines of text. But on this first night, the weight of the question pressed close. The lead detective closed the file for the evening and wrote a single sentence on the inside cover before the latch snapped. Find the 6 minutes. He believed the answer lived there. He believed it even as other cases stacked. He believed it the way people believe that dawn will come. He set the file on the corner of his desk and turned out the light. Outside, the street was empty. A trash can lid rattled and then stilled. A bus hissed at the corner and moved on. The gutter where he had fallen now held a small rim of ice. In the thin light from the pole, it looked like a small border drawn around a piece of a city that would not give up what it knew. The chapter ended with the same quiet it had started with. The question remained, clean and sharp in the cold. Chapter 2, The Vanishing Lead. Morning brought movement, and movement brought hope that usually faded by nightfall. The homicide office hummed in its low, constant way. Phones, keyboards, the murmur of detectives inside rooms. Each team working their open cases like slow fires that never quite went out. The board from the Naylor Road scene was up before 8. The victim now had a name, Marcus L., Ward, 27, resident of Southeast D.C., part-time delivery driver, no criminal record. A clean life on paper. The lead detective, Joseph Carter, stood at the board with a cup of coffee cooling in his hand. He circled three things: the missing phone contact, the car heard leaving the scene, and the time gap between the last text and the first call. 6 minutes. The same six he'd written on the file. The victim's life. By mid-morning, detectives met Marcus's mother again, this time in the kitchen of her home. The space smelled of bleach and coffee. Photos of Marcus lined a side shelf, birthdays, graduations, one from a community football game. He was working nights, she said quietly. Said he'd save enough to get us out of here by next year. They asked about the flower icon contact. She didn't recognize the name. A cousin thought it might be someone Marcus met through the delivery app. Maybe a customer, maybe a driver. Someone new. Someone recent. Detectives pulled Marcus's phone data from the cloud sync. The last 10 days showed a string of messages with the same contact. Short, casual, almost friendly. Meetups near parking lots. Small talk about movies. Then, 2 days before his death, a message that read, "Big night soon. Don't be late." Street canvas. Detectives returned to the block mid-morning. The overnight chill had lifted, but the street still felt cautious. A man sweeping his steps stopped long enough to point out tire marks leading toward the corner. Another neighbor mentioned seeing a dark sedan parked near a hydrant before the shots. He thought it was a gray Charger but wasn't sure. One of those with tinted windows. 2 blocks away, a convenience store security camera caught a blur of motion at 4:14 a.m., a car speeding through a red light. Frame-by-frame analysis confirmed a taillight pattern similar to a Dodge Charger. Partial plate unreadable. Still, it was something. Detective Carter looked at the footage twice, then 3 times. He slowed it to half speed and noted a reflection, maybe a parking sticker on the windshield. He forwarded it to the digital unit for enhancement. Leads thin out. By noon, the day's promise thinned. The phone data came back clean. No sign of major debts, no flagged contacts, no known gang links. The flower icon number traced to a prepaid phone registered under a false name, purchased in Maryland, shut off minutes after the shooting. Forensics had processed the casings, 9mm, same manufacturer, clean prints. No hits in the ballistic database yet. DNA swabs from the phone yielded only Marcus's touch. Carter's partner, Detective Serena Hill, leaned back from her monitor. "It's like somebody scrubbed the trail before it even started." Carter nodded. "Happens more now. Whoever did this knew what they were doing. Quick, cold, no panic." They stared at the whiteboard. Empty spaces were beginning to outnumber the notes. The pressure mounts. The lieutenant walked in, his tie already loose. "Press wants a statement. Public's calling about another murder with no arrests. Keep the details minimal. Focus on the ask for tips." Carter kept his tone even. "We need lab turnaround first. If we rush, we lose the details." The lieutenant gave a dry smile. "You'll lose attention first. Make it count while anyone's still listening." Outside, rain had begun to fall, a light mist turning the alleys slick and gray. Carter drove back to the scene alone. He parked where the tape had been and watched the block breathe again. Children on scooters. A mail truck stopping, moving on. The world repairing itself in small, guilty steps. He stepped out and looked down the gutter line where the casings had been. A single shard of reflective tape still clung to the pavement. He crouched, staring at it as if it might tell him something. A break that isn't. At 5 that evening, a call came from an officer at a pawn shop in Anacostia. A man had tried to sell a phone with a cracked screen, model matched Marcus's. But serial number check proved it wasn't his. The man's story collapsed quickly. He was trying to make rent. No connection. Another dead end. Carter rubbed his eyes. Too many ghosts in this city. They all start to sound the same. Night shift. Back at the office, Hill pinned a new photo to the board, a composite from security footage. A blurred shape, hoodie, approximate height, caught in reflection. Could be anyone. "We'll run it," she said. "Maybe someone in violent crimes recognizes the walk." Carter exhaled through his nose. Maybe. At 9 p.m., he walked the corridor alone. The hum of vending machines filled the space. On a wall of older case boards, yellow papers had faded to brown. Names crossed out or left open. He stopped at one dated 2018, another young man, similar street, same time of night. No resolution. The pattern sank in. The neighborhoods changed. The silence didn't. The clock. Back at his desk, Carter opened the file and wrote in the margin beside the 6-minute gap, "Check streetlight outages for that week." If one had been dark, it might explain why no one saw the shooter's face. He forwarded the request to City Utilities. He didn't expect an answer tonight. The rain kept falling, soft against the windows. Somewhere in the archive room, a printer started up again, spitting out lab requests for other open files. The rhythm sounded like a heartbeat, steady, resigned. Carter closed the folder. "Tomorrow," he said under his breath. In the city outside, buses sighed, horns echoed off wet streets, and 1,000 windows held 1,000 private stories that would never reach a report. The lead was vanishing already, slipping through hours and paperwork and memory. But he stayed a moment longer, tracing that 6-minute gap in his mind, seeing it not as time but as space, a dark alley between one life and another. He still believed the answer lived there. Chapter 3, Echoes in the File. The case moved into its quiet months, the long middle stretch that every detective hated. Files stacked up. Leads cooled. The hum of the city swallowed the echoes of January's gunfire. Detective Carter kept the file close, never buried under the others. He opened it each week like a ritual, scanning the same photographs and notes, hoping something would speak differently under new light. The board had thinned down to 3 names, none solid. The number registered to the flower icon contact remained dead. By March, the cherry trees around the city began to bloom. Life carried on in soft colors. Carter drove the same routes, Naylor Road, the side alleys, the stretch of cracked pavement where Marcus had fallen. People waved now. The shock had passed. But when he mentioned the case, faces tightened again. "Don't know nothing," one man said. "Wasn't out that night." "You were," Carter said. The man's eyes flicked away. "Wasn't looking da." That was the rhythm of unsolved work, truth hiding behind fear. The lab return. On March 15th, a digital unit report landed in Carter's inbox. It was thin, minor updates from new tower data. But one line caught his eye. A secondary SIM card had pinged the same tower as Marcus's phone minutes before the shooting. The number had since gone dark, but its activation location was a convenience store in Prince George's County. Carter printed the record and called Hill. "Another ghost number?" she asked. "Maybe. But this one was active 2 hours before. Somebody was close." They drove out that afternoon, rain again streaking across the windshield. The convenience store sat under flickering lights, old paint peeling. Inside, behind bulletproof glass, a clerk scrolled his phone, indifferent. Carter showed his badge and the activation form. "You sell prepaid phones?" "Everybody sells prepaid phones," the clerk said. "You keep video?" "Month back, maybe." They looked anyway. No luck. Cameras had looped and overwritten. The clerk shrugged. "You'll find what you find, officer." Outside, Hill watched the sky turn from gray to violet. "We're chasing ghosts." "Ghosts leave footprints," Carter said. "Even if they don't mean to. The family returns." In April, Marcus's mother called the station. She'd found a sealed envelope in his closet. Inside was a receipt for a cash deposit, $500 at a check cashing place 2 days before his death. No clear reason. Carter followed it up. The shop owner remembered Marcus vaguely, polite, quiet. "He said it was for someone else," the man recalled. "Didn't say who. Had a note with a name. Female. Short name. I didn't read it close." The handwriting on the receipt matched Marcus's. The note was gone. The pattern was thin, but it pointed back to trust, someone Marcus believed in enough to run an errand. Someone who used him as cover. May, a new thread. By early May, the case file had been reviewed twice for closure. Carter pushed back both times. "There's movement coming," he said. That movement arrived in a small envelope from the lab. New DNA extraction on the shell casings, using upgraded trace methods. A partial hit, not a full match, but enough to cross-check. The profile aligned with a known associate from a 2020 robbery case, named Devin Hartsfield, mid-30s, last known address in Maryland. Hill's pen froze above her notebook. "That's not our neighborhood." "No," Carter said. "But it's someone's connection." They pulled Hartsfield's file. Paroled the previous summer. Ties to small-time hustles. Nothing organized, but enough to live under the radar. A warrant went out to locate him. 2 days later, marshals hit the listed address. Apartment empty. Mail stacked. Utilities off. The neighbor said a man fitting Hartsfield's description had left a week after the January shooting. Destination unknown. Gone before the news cycle even faded, Hill said. Carter felt the small weight of it, the timing too neat to ignore. the interview. By June, a call came in from a neighboring county. A patrol stop had picked up Hartsfield on a broken taillight. No outstanding warrants yet, but when his name ran through the database, Carter's alert pinged. He and Hill drove down before sunrise. The interview room smelled of old coffee and cold air. Hartsfield sat at the table, wrists free but posture closed. Carter laid out a photograph of Marcus. "You ever seen this man?" Hartsfield looked once, then away. "Don't think so. Your DNA showed up at a homicide scene. We can talk about how, or we can wait until the lab confirms the secondary run." Hartsfield's jaw flexed. "You got nothing but air." Hill leaned forward. "You were in the area. Your phone pinged. You had motive, a handoff gone bad, maybe." He smiled faintly. "That boy called me. Said he wanted work. I told him I'd think about it. I never met him." Carter studied his face. The eyes held no fear, no guilt, just distance. After 2 hours, Hartsfield's lawyer walked in. The interview ended. The evidence wasn't enough. They released him under supervision. Outside the station, Hill kicked at gravel. "He's the one." "Maybe," Carter said. "But maybe someone else used him as the noise. The city moves on." By August, summer heat laid heavy over DC. The homicide count had climbed again. Each week brought new faces on the board. The department's press office stopped mentioning Marcus by name. But Carter couldn't close the file. He'd pass the old block sometimes, the corner where the tape had been, the lamppost that still flickered when rain fell. The kids who'd watched from their windows that morning were back playing under the same light. Life continued, and that was the hardest part. One evening, Marcus's mother stopped by the precinct. She carried a small framed photo. "I just want someone to remember him right," she said. "They always show the bad side when it's us. But he was good. Quiet. Tried to make it out." Carter nodded. "I know. He was one of the good ones." She handed him the frame. "Keep it. Maybe it'll remind someone to finish what they start." He took it. Set it beside his computer. It stayed there. Autumn. October brought another update. Not closure, but a whisper of it. The enhanced footage from the security camera showed a faint parking sticker on the fleeing car's windshield. Partial letters matched a rental fleet. Records confirmed a vehicle rented under an alias linked to Hartsfield's cousin. Returned the day after the shooting. But the cousin was dead, overdosed 6 months earlier. The thread snapped there. Carter filed the new evidence under pending. He leaned back in his chair that night, lights low, the hum of the building soft around him. He thought of Marcus's final moments, the unfinished text, the cold street, the silence after. The case had answers, just not in places the law could reach yet. Hill walked in with two coffees. "You ever think about leaving?" she asked. "Every week. And then I remember there's a mother waiting for a call that won't come if I do." She nodded, quiet understanding between them. The file. In December, almost a year after that cold morning, the homicide unit closed for the night early. Carter stayed behind. He opened the Naylor Road file one last time before the year rolled over. The photos, the notes, the fragments, they were all there, but the story was still missing its last page. He wrote a line across the top of the report before placing it in the open case drawer. Pending breakthrough. 2023 DC 017 remains active. Evidence points to deliberate coordination. Recommend rerun on all DNA in 12 months. He sealed it, slid it in place. Then he reached for the framed photo Marcus's mother had given him. He studied it for a long moment, the young man's easy smile, the sunlight caught in his eyes. Outside, a light rain began again, soft against the window. The same kind that had fallen that first night. Carter whispered, "I'll find your 6 minutes." He turned off the desk lamp. The station settled into silence. Somewhere out there, the city still held the truth, buried deep, waiting for the one question stubborn enough to bring it back to light.